We're back on Inside Out Transformation. We left off with the statement, we're more wicked and flawed than we ever dared believed, and more loved and affirmed than we ever dared hope. And I wrote this Latin phrase on the board for you. This was Martin Luther's explanation of what we're talking about there. And it's Latin, so it's simul justus et peccator. That should be it. That's an O there, peccator. Simul, which means same as, same. Justus is justified or righteous. And et peccator, sinful. That's our status. Simul, justus et peccator. At the same time, completely righteous and also sinful. Now, here's another one. I just learned this recently. This is... this was Augustine. These are three Latin phrases. Posse non peccare means... and this is the state of man before he sinned, before the fall. This is Adam and Eve in the garden. So Abel, we get like the word possible from that, Abel not to sin. So Adam and Eve had the ability to not sin. After the fall, we are non-passe, non-picar. We do not have the ability not to sin. Fallen. We don't have the ability to not sin. We sin. In the glorified state, fully redeemed universe, will be non-passe, non-picar, not able to sin again. And see, that's what God's redemption process is about. He is, by the time this whole thing's over, he'll have a family that can never sin again. The possibility of sin is a limit. When the mic's doing that, it usually means somebody's mobile phone's on and close to a microphone, so that might be. It's usually an indicator somebody's cheating. Used to happen a lot with our senior pastors. So that's where we're going, glorified state. Some point will be where we can't sin anymore. Sin is eliminated as a possibility from the universe. That's a good day. All right? We're still, remember, this is section one, the gospel, and we're answering it, or we're looking at it under four questions. Our first question is, what is the gospel? We've already seen it's the foundation of the Christian life. And it is summarized by these statements. It's a past event and a current status. Then our next thought, our next subpoint under what is the gospel, the two essentials for understanding the gospel are the magnitude of my debt and the greatness of his provision. You see, you need to have both of those. Now, I told you that the gospel reveals that you're more wicked and flawed than you ever dared believe. As you look at, examine, understand the gospel, you find out that you're a lot more sinful than in your wildest imagination you ever believed possible. That's the magnitude of your debt. See? But then the gospel also shows you the greatness of his provision. You have to have both of those to get it right. And some religious groups and organizations emphasize one over the other. Now, as a Roman Catholic, and I was Roman Catholic, my parents on both sides, as far back as you can go in our genealogical tree, and I have ancestors that I know of dated back to 1546. Roman Catholic, as far back as you can go. Roman Catholic grade school I went to, Roman Catholic high school. I mean, it's about as Roman Catholic as you get. I certainly learned in that environment the magnitude of my debt. I knew I was a sinner. They're good at making you feel bad. Okay? Now, there are other Christian organizations, movements, the faith movement. You find a lot about the greatness of his provision. You see, when I was a Roman Catholic, I knew about the magnitude of my debt, but I didn't know anything about the greatness of his provision. So if you emphasize the magnitude of his debt, you'll be humble, but you can't look anybody in the eye. If you emphasize the greatness of his provision, you'll have confidence, but you'll be arrogant. See, when you get them both together, you're really humble because you see just how wicked you are. And at the same time, really confident because you see how loved and affirmed you are. You see, only in the gospel can you get both together. Simul justus et peccator. So here's an example. If you came to my house in Nashville and stayed there while I was gone for a week, say, and I came back and you said, while you were gone, a bill came in the mail, and maybe I shouldn't have done this, but I opened it and I paid it for you. Well, I don't know how to feel yet, because I have to ask you the all-important question. Which bill? Because let's say in my analogy there was two that I was anticipating. One maybe was a $10 fine from my library for overdue books. Okay, if you paid the $10 bill, that's great. I'm thankful. I shake your hand and say thank you. Now, I could remind you how much money I saved you in hotel bills by staying at my house, but I won't do that. I'll just say thank you. You paid the bill. But if you paid that other bill, let's say $250,000 U.S. dollars, an IRS back tax bill. Do you know what the IRS is? You have something like that here, right? That's the tax man. Money that I could never pay back. The bill keeps getting larger each year. If you paid that bill, now I fall on my knees and worship you. See, there's a completely different response because of my awareness of, first of all, the magnitude of my debt and the greatness of your provision. Now, you see, if you paid that first bill for me and then you asked me to do you a favor, say I'm running late, I got to get to the airport, and I left my laundry at this place, can you go pick up my laundry for me? Well, I might do it. But I'd probably be grumbling the whole time, thinking it was only 10 bucks. Who does he think he is asking me to go run his errand? Why don't he go get his own stupid laundry? But if you paid the second bill, and then you asked me to run a few errands, my attitude would be totally different. You see, my attitude would be, there's nothing too great that you could ask of me. And when people encounter the gospel, when they see the magnitude of their debt and the greatness of his provision, there's nothing too great that he could ask of us. Sometimes we're trying to get people more committed, right? We need to get them more committed. So let's exhort them about commitment. No, present the gospel. The gospel reveals the magnitude of your debt and the greatness of his provision. When you see that, there's nothing too great that he could ask of you. We see this in Isaiah chapter 6 when Isaiah has the encounter of going into God's presence and seeing the manifested glory of Jesus Christ. And, of course, what was Isaiah's response? Do you remember Isaiah chapter 6? Woe is me, I am undone. I'm a man of unclean lips. Now, here's Isaiah. He is, at this point, he's a prophet in Israel. One of the truly great prophets. A man known for his oratorical skills and his writing ability. It's interesting, people who study things like this tell us that the book of Isaiah ranks in the very top of all literature ever written by any people at any time. They list it. People who study comparative literature, it's listed as one of the highest forms of literary art in the history of the world. Isaiah, before he went to the temple, I'm sure if you asked him, Isaiah, how's your spiritual life? Strong, great, devotional life, worshiping God, good, power, yeah, prophesying. But 1 second after a revelation of God, woe is me. And he uses that woe, that word in a technical sense. The Hebrew prophets had two basic categories of prophesying. There was first category is called the prophecy of weal. That's W-E-A-L. It's a weal is an old English word. We get our word wealth, wealthy from it. A prophecy of weal is a prophecy of blessing, prosperity, abundance, good things to come. If you're going to get a prophecy from an Old Testament prophet, that's the one you want. A prophecy of weal, W-E-A-L. The other general category, it's actually more common, is the prophecy of woe. Remember, Jesus gave some prophecies. He said, woe to you, Bethsaida. Woe to you, Chorazin. Woe is a technical term. It means damnation, judgment, condemnation. This is not the kind of prophecy that you want. Now, out of all of the prophecies we get from the Hebrew prophets, this is the only time that a prophet prophesies woe against himself. You see, because we don't understand the background, we say woe, we read the word woe, it just sounds like some dude's going, whoa, whoa, this is bad, whoa. That's not what he's saying. He said, woe to me. Condemnation, judgment. What he's saying, I deserve to be damned, for I'm a man of unclean lips. Isn't it interesting? When we see God for who he is, the attributes that we think are our very best, Isaiah was known, he's a golden tongue orator, a brilliant communicator, and yet the thing he's most aware of, even my lips, the best part of me is unclean. And the next thing that happens in verse 6, after he prophesies what? Judgment, I should be damned, the angel goes to the altar, gets fire. We miss this because we think of fire in a New Testament context, which is usually purification. But fire in the Old Testament context is usually judgment. And Isaiah knows his Bible, unlike most of us, and he knows the altar goes back, dates back to Leviticus chapter 10. That's the same altar when the two sons of Aaron, Nadab and Abihu, offer strange fire before the Lord, if you remember that story. And fire comes from the presence of the Lord and burns them to a crisp. Isaiah has just prophesied damnation to himself. The angel gets the fire from the altar of judgment and starts heading towards him. What is Isaiah assured of? This is it, baby. I am toast. No, I mean toast, literally. Literally, I'm going to be ashes in a moment. And instead, the angel takes that coal and purifies his heart. You see, one moment after he realized he was more wicked and flawed than he ever dared believe possible, he realizes he's more loved and affirmed than he ever dared believe he could hope. And what's his response? The immediate response, here am I, send me. Now, if I was there, I would have stopped and said, Isaiah, wait, get the job description first. Find out what he's asking. Because one thing we know about Isaiah is probably the person referred to in Hebrews chapter 11. You know, it talks about some who were sawn in two. Do you remember that from Hebrews chapter 11? That's probably a reference to Isaiah, who ended his life as a martyr, and they killed him slowly by first cutting off his arms, sawing his arms off, and then sawing his legs. And of course, he's still alive. And then they began to saw, and just sawed him in two until he was dead. Say, Isaiah, wait for the job description, but it doesn't matter. When you see the magnitude of your debt and the greatness of his provision, there's nothing too great he can ask of you. See? That's the gospel. And as we see the magnitude of our debt every day more clearly, and the greatness of his provision more clearly, our heart is transformed and changed. And there's a new willing response. Lord, there's just nothing you could ask of me that would be too great. Nothing at all. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
That's our first question. What is the gospel? Okay? Second thing we have to ask to understand this is, what is the alternative to the gospel? What is the alternative to the gospel? And why is it so appealing? Why is it so appealing? And it is. I mentioned I'm a student of church history. And the sad reality is the church very quickly left the pure gospel. And throughout history, men and women have preferred the alternative to the gospel. What is the alternative, and why is it so appealing? The alternative, first subpoint, to the gospel is moralism. Moralism. You don't know how to spell it, it's the next word. Moralism is an approach to Christianity that focuses on external behavior. It requires obedience to the command of God without... I used to have a typo there. Do I have... What does it say? Without? Okay, good. I corrected it. Good. Without connecting those commands to the cross of Christ. You understand? That's the key. Moralism focuses on external behavior, on obedience. You might say, well, what's wrong with that? I thought we were supposed to be obedient. It focuses on obedience without connecting the commands to the cross. So the emphasis is on obedience, what we do, not on what he did and what we can do because of what he did. Moralism. And this has been the default mode of the church for 2,000 years. This is where men's hearts go very, very quickly. Why? After what we just heard about the gospel, which is so refreshing, isn't it? Why would our hearts run to moralism? I'm so glad you asked me that question. What's the alternative? Why is it so appealing? Our next fill-in. The alternative is so appealing because it keeps our pride intact. It keeps our pride intact. You see, moralism appeals to our pride. It appeals to, we did it. I feel good about myself. I awoke early today and prayed successfully for 1 hour. Now, I know you didn't, but that's okay. I was praying for you. It keeps our pride intact. We see the classic example of this in Galatians chapter 3. This is my version. combining several translations. Paul says, you unthinking and foolish Galatians, who has put the evil eye on you? Have you taken leave of your senses? For it's obvious you no longer have the crucified Jesus in clear focus. His sacrifice on the cross was certainly set before you clearly enough. Let me ask you this one question. How did your new life begin? Was it by working your heads off to please God? Or was it by hearing and believing God's message? Are you going to continue this insanity? For only crazy people would think they could complete by their own efforts what was begun by God. If you weren't smart enough or strong enough or good enough to start it, how do you suppose you could finish it? Wow, that says it all. Why is this Galatian syndrome so common? And we all have to admit, we all have our own inner Galatian that's trying to get out every day. Why is it? You see, because if grace is totally free, then what that means is that's a picture of me that's just more flawed and sinful and wicked than I want to believe. If there's something that I can contribute, I don't feel quite so bad about myself. Just even the littlest bit. After World War II in the U.S., a lot of women who had been working because their husbands were off at war, after the war, they continued in the workforce, and there was a vast migration of women from the home into the workforce. As a result of that, American businesses began to come up with labor-saving devices for women who are now spending a lot of their time at work. And one of the inventions that this company thought was going to just be a great sale was the Instant Cake Mix. Now, the first iteration of the Instant Cake Mix was all you did is took the material in the box, put it in a bowl, got some water from the tap, stirred it up, put it in the oven, you had a cake. Brilliant, right? But you know what happened? Nobody would buy it. Nobody would buy it. And they did market research. And they asked people to find out what's going on. And you know what they found out as they talked to the women? It's just too easy. It can't be that easy. And they were suspicious about it. So they went back and they changed the recipe. And most of the women all know. Now, all the new, since then, cake mixes, same thing, pour water, put it in, but now you add one egg. And people started buying it like crazy. Isn't that funny? See, because there was something I contributed. Now, that's the Galatian syndrome, you see. If we could just add, even if just one little egg, just make one. Can we make some contribution? Then that means I'm not so bad. If it's all grace, if it's all Jesus, then I must be a lot more wicked than I want to face. Let me just put my egg in, Lord. But God, unlike the Instant Cake Company, will not go back and rework his formula. It's Christ plus nothing equals everything. And Christ plus your one egg equals nothing. But see, that one egg keeps some of our pride intact. But that's not what the gospel is. The gospel, you see your next point. The gospel insults us. Anybody been insulted by the gospel? If you've never been insulted by the gospel, there's a good chance you don't even know what it is. The gospel is insulting. The gospel insults us by saying we're too stupid and too sinful to obey or follow God. Too stupid and too sinful. You see, the Bible, both in the Old and New Testament, refers to us as sheep. Right? Now, we don't live in a sheep culture, do we? And so we miss the insult. Because it is an insult. Our tendency, when we think about sheep, we think little cartoon sheep. Aren't they cute, cuddly? Maybe a little stuffed animal that one of our children had. Jesus is calling us his sheep. He's insulting us. He's telling us how stupid we are. Sheep are incredibly stupid. I preached a sermon where I used this illustration at our Every Nation Church in Seattle. And I got an email from one of the guys in the church who had been raised on a farm. They had sheep. And so he sent me stupid sheep stories. My favorite one was, at this particular time, they only had two sheep. And they had them in a fenced location like you have to with sheep. Because they're too stupid to know what to do. But the fence was being repaired and they had to leave town. So they tethered the two sheep to a pole. And they were only going to be gone a few days. But when they got back, the one sheep, the lead sheep, had just walked around this pole. Just in circles around the pole. Of course, each time it goes around the pole, the cord that's attached is getting shorter and shorter. And finally, he just walked to the end and he hung himself. So they came on, there's just a dead sheep, just hung himself. The other sheep followed the lead sheep. He couldn't hang himself because the dead sheep was in his way. He couldn't get past him. So he was alive, but he had tangled himself up. He was so far from the water bowl, he couldn't get any water, and he was about to die of thirst. Now, they rescued that one, fortunately. But that's how stupid sheep are, you see. They're different than a dog. Dogs are smart, okay? Dogs get lost. You call your dog, and he comes, and he walks home with you. I have a little dog that I miss a lot when I live here named Lucy. Lucy's a Cairn Terrier. A Cairn is, if you've ever seen the movie Wizard of Oz, Toto is a Cairn Terrier. So that's my little Lucy. And when Lucy was young, if she'd get out of the house, she'd get lost. And so we'd go wandering around the neighborhood, and she'd be digging something because she's a terrier, and that's what they do. And we would find her and call out to her, Lucy. And she'd see us and be really happy, and she'd come running to us. There's a glorious reunion. And then I would lead her home, and she would follow, you see. Now, if your sheep gets lost, no bother to call them because they're too stupid to follow. You have to pick the sheep up and carry the sheep back, you see. Now, every other religion in the world treats us like we're a lost puppy dog. Only the gospel treats us like we're a lost sheep. You see the idea of every other religion of the world. We're lost. Yeah, we need help. But all we need is someone to show us the way and we can follow. See, we just need a teacher. Someone show us the way. But the gospel says we don't need a teacher. We need a savior. Not someone we can follow. Someone who will carry us. That's the gospel, you see. It insults us. It says, you're too stupid. You could never figure this out. And even if you did, you're too sinful. You never would follow. That's what the gospel does. It insults us. And that's why the alternative is so appealing, because it doesn't insult us. It actually makes us feel good about ourselves, because it was our contribution. And that's the natural tendency of our heart. That's why we have to ask this third question. Then why must we preach the gospel to ourselves every day. Now, see, that's an interesting way to phrase it. Most of the time when you hear this, you're being told to preach the gospel to others. Well, I think that's important. But before you do that, preach the gospel to yourself. Every single day. Why do we have to preach the gospel to ourselves every day? Because even though we understand enough of the gospel to be converted, to be born again, to be converted, the actual way our heart works is not immediately changed. The default mode of our heart is always works. It's always self-salvation project. Well, I want to say it now, but I'm going to wait. But Lee convinced me to go see Les Miserables because he was singing it all last week. And I was just so inspired. I was a little nervous because it's all singing. Yeah. All singing. I didn't think I could handle that. But it was magnificent. I was completely mesmerized. And I've become a fanatic ever since. So, matter of fact, I had been reading, you know, the book is 1,500 pages, one of the longest novels in history. I'd read 750 pages because my daughter challenged me. She read it the first time at 16. By the time she's 20, she'd read it four times through. So I thought I'd better read it. But I'd gone 750 pages, which is three books, and you're only halfway through. But I'm back. I'm gonna finish it now. But I love watching it. But it is a case study on idolatry. And when we get to the actual idolatry, I got all kinds of new illustrations from Les Miserables. So. And all the characters, you see. Self-salvation projects. Each one of them have their own unique self-salvation project. That's how our heart works. Even still, you see, we are, although fully justified, still sinful. The default mode goes back to our own self-salvation project. And so we have to preach the gospel to ourselves every day. Now, one of the ways that I do that, I do my devotions. I use Evernote for my devotions because I keep all my files of all my scriptures under a file called Scripture Confession. And then I have a number of, I think I have 29 different documents on different topics that I want to meditate on. So I open one document and I call it the magnitude of my debt. And it's all the Bible verses about how sinful I am. So Genesis chapter 6, and God saw that every thought of the intent of the heart was only evil continually. Yes, Lord, that's me. Every intent of the thought of my heart is only evil continually. Jeremiah 17, verse 9, the heart is more deceitful than all else. Yes, Lord, that's my heart. And then I'll work my way into the New Testament, Romans chapter 1, that list, that description of fallen man, and all the sin lists, reading them. That's me, Lord, you're describing. Now, you always want to make sure that your devotion doesn't get interrupted and that you end there because it's going to be it's going to be a bad day. But you see, it's producing real humility.
Yeah.
Real, genuine humility. I'm thinking about what I am and seeing myself more and more clearly every day as the sinner that I am. But then I open the next document, the greatness of his provision. Though you were dead in your sins, and then we start that, but God made you alive together with him and raised us up with him and seated with him in the heavenly places, far above all rule and power and authority and dominion and every name that is named, in order that in the ages to come, he might show the surpassing riches of his grace in kindness towards me. Yes. I start seeing the greatness of his provision, you see. And I'm preaching the gospel to myself every day. Every day. So it goes deeper and deeper. And whatever particular sin I'm dealing with, I deal with that one. Let your gospel go deeper. Penetrate my heart. I need to see how wicked and sinful I am and how great you are in your provision for me. Every day, preaching the gospel to myself. Notice our quote here. The gospel is the solution to every problem. The key to every closed door and the power through every barrier. Every part of our life has to be transformed piece by piece by more deeply reflecting on, believing in, and applying the gospel. Martin Luther, one of my favorites in church history, and he's always a great one for a quote. Martin Luther talking about this, he said, the gospel is the principal article of the Christian faith. It is necessary that we know this well, teach it to others, and beat it into their heads continually. I love that. Beat it into my head continually. That's what I'm trying to do every day with the gospel. Just beat it into my head. I want to be hammered with the gospel every day as it's piece by piece transforming every area of jealousy and selfishness and sinfulness. Every specific sin in my life is being transformed bit by bit as the gospel is hammering my life every single day. See, our next point, because let me say something before we say that. I used to have this computer program. This was years ago. I'm real particular about my computer and real fussy about how it looks and how things are arranged. And so when I have a program that I use a lot, I want the desktop. I want everything to be organized. You know, I like to create my own little menus and get all the icons exactly how I want them. And I work hard to get it all set up just right, okay? Just how I am. Actually, that explains a lot about me right there. That's a good metaphor. And I had this program and I worked real hard to get everything right. And then every time I would close that program or shut down the computer and reboot, it would go back to the default. And I have to go through that whole process again. And it was time consuming, you know. And I did all the check, and I found out in the end it was just a design flaw in that program. It was just that's how it worked. But I thought that's a great metaphor for us as human beings. You see, the gospel gets things in order, gets our life straightened out. But every time we shut the program down and reboot, it's back to the default mode, self-salvation project. And I think we reboot every night when we go to bed. Every time when we wake up in the morning, we're rebooting. Every morning we start back with the default mode, self-salvation project. So every day, you got to preach the gospel to yourself every single day. It's resetting the desktop. Yes, it's time consuming, but it's absolutely necessary. Because we're not justified by the gospel and then sanctified by obedience. But the gospel is the way we grow and are renewed. Someone said it to me, I can't remember, maybe John, it was you, that as Filipinos, we get the idea of justification by faith through the gospel. But the idea of sanctification by faith through the gospel is a little bit more difficult to grasp. And I think one of the reasons I saw this chart a number of years ago. Let's see, we got an erase here. Yes.
Is it through faith or by faith?
Where? What?
Through faith.
Through where?
Through faith or by faith.
Yes.
Yes.
those prepositions work. Yeah. Just think about, like in Tagalog, you just have one word, one preposition, right? That covers everything. So, by, through, they all work. By faith, through faith, same thing. Okay, this is your life, right? Mike, I'm going to pick on you. Mike, what year were you born?
1978.
1978, okay.
Come on.
One of the older fellas here in the room. Okay, here's Mike. He's going around as a child, but now here's his life. He's sinning. You know what? I need to start down here. Okay. Sin. What year were you born again? Come on, Mike.
Oh, 1978. Born again.
2012.
You were born saved. Mike, you need to be in this class. Mike, 2005, he's sinning. Whoa, 2005, born again, transformed. Gospel changed his life. Now, two things begin to happen. Number one, as you start to read the Bible and start to hear preaching, you start finding out how holy God is. And see, we get this increasing view of the holiness of God. Right? I remember I was born again in 1976 as a 19-year-old college student, and I was amazed week after week, month after month, when I found out, you mean that's a sin? I had no idea that was a sin. Yeah. Like, I thought, man, I'm really proud. And then I found out that's a sin. I thought that was a good character quality. Man, there's just a lot more sin than I ever imagined. God is a lot more holy than I ever imagined. Yeah. At the same time, because of the process of the Holy Spirit, I'm seeing, woo, how sinful I am. All right? Now, I knew I was sinful here. Mike knew he was sinful here. That's why he got saved. But you had no idea, did you? You had no idea. And it keeps getting worse and worse and worse. And this gap starts to grow in our Christian life. Now, at the moment of conversion, it's a revelation of the cross of Jesus Christ that bridges the gap between our limited view of God's holiness and our limited view of our sinfulness. Here's the problem. Throughout our Christian life, this understanding of the cross, of the gospel, it doesn't get much bigger. And so year by year, the gap gets greater and greater. And we fill it generally with two things. Number one, performance. Whew, I got performance. I got to work harder, man. I definitely got to pray more. I got to fast more. I got to show up to more victory something or others. I got to do more. Or another way we fill it on the other end is dishonesty. We just don't really face what we really are. So we cover up in all kinds of ways. We make ourselves feel, look, think that we're better than we really are. But all of those are dysfunctional, and that's actually not Christianity. But what should happen as we progress our understanding of the cross has to grow. It has to magnify. It has to continually fill the gap between God's holiness and our sinfulness. You see, that's what the gospel does. Every day, we keep filling up. We keep seeing more and more what the cross is all about. That's why every sermon should be Christ-centered. Bring us back to the cross. Because our greatest need for sanctification is not five principles, six steps. Our greatest need for sanctification is to understand what Christ did for us and how His work fills the gap between God's immense holiness and our incredible sinfulness. That's what the gospel is. Every day seeing that cross is getting bigger and bigger and bigger. Not that it gets any bigger. It's our understanding grows and gets bigger every day. You see, that's the gospel sanctifying, changing our life. And our last subpoint under this, all of our problems come from a lack of understanding the gospel and applying it to specific areas of our life. All of our problems come from a lack of understanding the gospel and applying it to every area of our life. Now I'm going to try to prove that to you throughout the rest of our seminar as we create, as we go through this. Everything comes down to there's something about the gospel that you don't understand, you don't believe, or you're not applying to your life. The answer to every problem is in the gospel. But there's something in the gospel that you don't understand yet, something you don't really believe from the heart, or something you haven't actually applied to that area of your life. That's why the gospel, our quote, is the only thing that will tell us what's really wrong with us. And it's the only thing that will give us real answers to fix our problems. And it's the only thing that will give us the power to do what's right. How are we doing so far? Does this make sense? Are we clear? Jerome, tell me what's the most important thing you've heard so far about this. Right in that mic that's sitting right in front of you. What's the most important thing for you personally that you've heard so far?
Well, personally, what stood up for me is the gospel. I had a really revelation.
What part of the gospel? Give
the me gospel that.
Like what stood out the most?
At the same time, I'm sinful, and also at the same time, having that provision, great provision from God as well.
Yeah. Excellent. So. Great. All right, let's do this. Let's break now. And because I can't really start this next one, it'll take me too long.